This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Security forces also fired tear gas and water cannon on pro-democracy protesters in central Khartoum, Omdurman, Khartoum North, and other cities across the country.
That's Michael Atit reporting on the protests in Khartoum, which have left several people dead. Details coming up. Also, a court in Uganda has released opposition figure Kizza Besigye on bail today. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Protesters are back on the streets again in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, today, a day after several died in clashes with security forces. Medics say more than 500 others were injured in the anti-coup protests. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Dr. Abdurrahim Ali Dobora, a member of the Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors, says 9 protesters were killed on Thursday, while another protester succumbed to his injuries this morning in a hospital in Khartoum. Dr. Dobora says security forces fired live bullets at the protesters.
Here we lost one, which is the direct gunshot to his head. And we have 200 injured protesters with variation in the injury from minor to moderate and severe. And unfortunately, 2 of them lost their eye.
Security forces also fired tear gas and water cannon on pro-democracy protesters in central Khartoum, Omdurman, Khartoum North, and other cities across the country. The government cut off internet service and telephone communication before the protests began on Thursday. Dr. Dobora says, despite limited access to the internet, preliminary reports from the field indicate at least 500 protesters were wounded in Khartoum alone.
In another hospital in Bahni, also total number of injuries, I communicate with them about 150. And here in this hospital, it's 200. And Omdurman definitely will cross more than 200 and so on. So we were estimating that it be around 500 to 600 injured.
Police authorities in Khartoum State said in a statement last night that 96 police and 129 armed forces were injured on Thursday. The statement said a group of protesters destroyed water jet vehicles and set fire to trees east of the White Nile Bridge near hotels and a mosque. Police say an unknown number of arrested protesters are facing criminal charges but did not elaborate. A group calling themselves the Emergency Lawyers announced they documented the arrest of 150 demonstrators. The lawyers said the arrested are being held at Soba Prison and Omdurman Women's Prison. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum, Osman Haider, a member of the resistance committee who participated in yesterday's protest, says Sudanese citizens are demanding an immediate end to military rule and the formation of a democratic civilian-led government.
Yesterday's protest has carried very clear points on falling down of Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the military council and end up the process of the COP and the establishment of the of a civil authority and democratic system of government in Sudan.
Protesters also called for an investigations into the killings, arbitrary arrest, and disappearance of protesters in previous demonstrations. Haider says pro-democracy protesters will continue to push for an end to military rule in the country through peaceful means. The United States Embassy in Khartoum condemned the use of force against the demonstrators and described it as a tragic loss of life. The trilateral mechanism, AU, IGAD, and UNITAMS also condemned the excessive use of force by security forces and expressed their disappointment with Sudanese authorities. The protests in Khartoum and other cities marked the third anniversary of the large demonstrations during the uprising that led to the overthrow of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir and a power-sharing government between civilian groups and the military. That transitional government ended when the military staged a coup in October last year. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A court in Uganda released opposition figure Kizza Besigye on bail today after he spent 2 weeks in jail awaiting trial on charges of inciting violence. Reuters reports that the 66-year-old Besigye was detained on June 14th in the capital Kampala as he led protests against skyrocketing consumer prices. Ugandans have expressed widespread anger at surging prices for fuel, cooking oil and other goods, and government's refusal to cushion consumers. Besigye has been calling for tax cuts to offset inflation, but President Yoweri Museveni has rejected the idea, blaming high prices on the war in Ukraine and the COVID-19 pandemic. Museveni has been in power since 1986, and the opposition and critics have accused him of rigging polls and using security forces to hold on to power. Museveni denies the accusations. Besigye has run unsuccessfully against Museveni 4 times, alleging the results of the elections as fraudulent. He has been arrested dozens of times. Libyan Parliament Speaker Aguila Saleh and President of the High Council of State Khalid al-Mashri met at the United Nations in Geneva for 3 days of talks to discuss the draft constitutional framework for elections. The talks aimed at breaking the deadlock over the rules for long-awaited elections failed to resolve key differences between the rival sides. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the differences that led to the talks' failure.
At first, let me highlight there were some positive agreements, including about the allocation of Senate seats, the upper chamber, 1/3 for each region, the seat of this upper chamber in SEPA, the HOR seat in Benghazi, Arabic as the official language, not so clear as there are several minorities in Libya with their own language who were not mentioned, and Islamic law, as they say, as the official source of laws. But there is no agreement about the criteria for presidential candidates, and that's a crucial question. Controversial points are if persons with dual citizenships and members of the military are allowed to run. The High Council of State Chair Khalid al-Mashri is strictly against this, as this would allow the controversial LNA commander Khalifa Haftar to run. He has a US citizenship and is a military member. This is also a no-go, not only for al-Mashri, but also for the various Islamist groups in Libya and many others in the western part of the country. On the other side, it is a must for a lot of people in the east. I would like to remind that it's also a fact that there is a dual citizenship of GNU Prime Minister Dabeiba. So if this is voted into law, also Dabeiba would not be eligible to run.
Many Libyans fear that a failure to set a path to elections and resolve the existing disputes over control of an interim government will push the country back towards territorial division and conflict. Is that a legitimate fear?
Yes, I would say this is a very realistic scenario. In the meantime, there are not only many voices in the east of the country calling for a regional government, but also in the south. Just a few days ago, there was a meeting of tribal leaders in Ubari in Fezzan. Among those who met there were many people who openly support Gaddafi's son Saif al-Islam. And they announced that they will establish a regional government in Sebha, the capital of Fezzan, to take care of the many local problems. I would say federalism is certainly a way, maybe the best way forward for Libya, but without a proper and agreed constitutional framework, including a formula for the distribution of the oil revenues, this could very, very easily lead to a new war.
UN Libya advisor Stephanie Williams said that she would make recommendations on alternative ways forward. And the U.S. Libya ambassador Richard Norland said it would be possible to go ahead with an election even if the stalemate between the rival governments of Dabeiba and Bashagha was not resolved and different forces controlled different regions. What's your take on that?
While not entirely unrealistic, this would be very, very challenging to organize. They would need to work exactly exactly under the same rules and laws. And this is precisely where they disagree. This would also somehow imply that Dabega recognizes Bashagha and vice versa, which is not the case right now. They would also need to agree which government organizes the elections in which parts and in which cities of the country. Also a quite controversial question. Furthermore, it would also mean that the Central Bank of Libya would need to allocate funds to Bashagha, which CBL Governor Al-Kabir is currently not willing to do. Several members of the Tripoli-based High Council of State and the Tobruk-based House of Representatives have already rejected the proposal, but I would say we'll see.
That was Wolfgang Porchtai, former Austrian military attaché, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The United Nations and its partners have been trying to resolve the political standoff in Libya that began late last year when elections were postponed. Since then, Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabiba has remained in office. However, the parliament appointed Fatih Bashagha as prime minister. Tanzanian authorities say violent clashes this month between police and ethnic Maasai villagers being evicted from their ancestral homes have left one officer dead and scores of villagers wounded. Rights groups are condemning the government's action as some Maasai families begin to leave for new homes far away. Charles Kombe reports from Handeni, Tanzania.
A 63-year-old Saibo Kulaiza has found a new home in eastern Tanzania's Handeni township. It's about 600 kilometers south of his ancestral land in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. Liza has three wives and 20 children. In this new environment, he is worried about the fate of their long-preserved tradition, including living in a traditional Maasai bomas. Liza says in Ngorongoro, the laws were strict and people were instructed about what to do with their land. So they had much time to invest in their tradition. But for now, he adds, the tradition of living in bomas, living with Maasai cattle, may diminish. He is among Maasai people who have left their land after a government eviction that has sparked protests and a violent police crackdown. Government officials say the Maasai have been asked to voluntarily leave their homes, located in parts of the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. They also say the goal of the eviction is to protect the conservation area from a growing Maasai population and their cattle. But activists say they are being forced out to make way for trophy hunting and conservation zones. Onesmo Lengurumwa is the executive director of Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition. Onesmo says they have been advising citizens to sit together with their government and write down their recommendations, and they have done that. The challenge comes on the government's side. It was like officials didn't want to receive or pay attention to the recommendations. What they did was continue with the strategies they already had planned. He says it is the government that has led the people to this stage. About 27 Maasai families already have shifted from Ngorongoro to Msomera village, where the government provides those evicted with a house and land where they can let their cattle graze. Martin Oleikayo is the Msomera village chairperson. Martin says the president's plan to move Maasai from the Ngorongoro conservation area is for the benefit of all the country. For all wild animals, they are for all of Tanzania. So, he adds that all the revenues collected from tourism activities from the conservation area benefit all citizens. Meanwhile, Liza is adjusting to a new life and a new home. But he's worried about those more than 300 families that remain in the area, who are reluctant to leave the only home they have ever known. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Handeni, Tanga, Tanzania.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. In the northwest of Ethiopia's Afar region, landmines left over from the 19-month Tigray conflict are making herders struggle with a record-breaking drought even deadlier. Landmines have killed children and livestock and are making people afraid to collect water despite the drought. Henry Wilkins reports from Chifra, Ethiopia.
The battles between Ethiopian government-aligned troops and Tigrayan forces may have stopped, but herders in western Afar region are left fighting for survival. The record drought in the Horn of Africa that has killed millions of livestock has been made worse by landmines left by combatants. Herder Hassan Arebti Hassan's four-year-old daughter was injured by a landmine, and they're also killing his animals. He says landmines are everywhere around here, and many animals have died because they've stepped on them, the landmines. He says goats stand on them and they explode. Landmines and other explosives are so common here that some locals use the wood from their crates as building materials. 9-year-old Ali Amer says his 10-year-old friend was killed by a landmine while they were herding goats together. He describes how he left the house with his friend to go and tend to the goats. We were just there to take care of the goats, but my friend died, he said matter-of-factly. He says his friend was playing, throwing stones at the landmine. Then he picked it up and threw it to the ground. Ali was also injured. His father says landmines make them all afraid to collect water, despite the drought. He says there's a serious drought here and that it's difficult for the people and the animals. The community doesn't know what to do, and he spent a lot of money to buy food for family and animals. We need the landmines removed from the area where we used to live, he says. After speaking with locals, VOA was unable to establish which side in the conflict was responsible for laying the mines. Bekele Gonfar is executive director of a non-profit in Addis Ababa that supports landmine victims. He says people in mined areas of Ethiopia, like Chifra, need help.
Number one is the medical treatment. And then they've been provided to with psychosocial support, which includes peer counseling, particularly that's what we organization is basically engaged in and operating in. The public and the community has to be given mine risk education in order to really keep themselves away from the mines.
But with the ongoing droughts, people in Chifra have little choice but to risk landmines if they want to find food for their animals and collect water for their survival. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Chifra, Ethiopia.
An underwater art museum has opened off the coast of Senegal to shed light on ocean pollution and overfishing. The museum, which is the first of its kind in West Africa, serves not only as a work of art, but as a living nursery for fish and coral. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Waves lap up against the beach outside Oceanium, a scuba diving center and environmental organization in Dakar's Southern Plateau neighborhood. About 100 meters offshore and 5 meters below, 8 sculptures rise from the ocean floor. Dutch and Italian artists Misha Sanders and Philip Putzer created the sculptures during an art residency in Dakar. VOA and other media were not able to visit the sculptures during a planned visit Monday due to poor visibility and rough seas. The works debuted at Dakar's Art Biennale, which continues through Tuesday. The goal is to bring more awareness to the pollution that surrounds the sculptures and thereby encourage a conversation about the environment. Charlotte Thomas is Oceanium's head of communications.
You see here in Senegal, the pollution is everywhere. You go in Dakar, you see waste all around you. And all that waste with the raining season who's coming is going to go into the sea. So if we are not protecting our land, we cannot protect our sea.
Besides Senegal's rampant plastic pollution, a surge of development projects over the last decade has transformed the coastline and eroded fragile ecosystems. Fish stocks have plummeted as commercial and artisanal fishing boats continue to use unsustainable fishing practices. In 2015, the government passed a law banning single-use plastics, but it was never enforced. Since then, versions of the law have passed, including in 2020, when legislation specifically targeted plastic cups, straws, plates, bags, and bottles, but those never went into effect either. Senegal-born Radwan El Ali is the diving director of Oceanium and for the underwater exhibit. El Ali has spent much of his life diving in Dakar. He says, I live underwater, and I can see that the areas that were so beautiful when I was young, today not only are there no fish left, but they've been replaced by plastic bottles, cans, and all sorts of things. It's painful for me. El Ali says he used to see plenty of dolphins, whales, and sharks, and he would catch fish that were his size. Now, there's barely anything left, he says. Since the sculptures were placed underwater in December, they have given rise to their own ecosystem. The clay structures are covered in barnacles, shellfish, and urchins. Fish visit frequently to find refuge and feed on algae. Umi Dia is a specialist of contemporary art. What she finds most interesting about the installation, she said, is that the statues look like coral, a unique sight in Dakar's barren waters.
The bay is just full of sand. There's absolutely no coral. So it's interesting to see how contemporary art is trying to mimic what nature can bring by exploring natural ingredients that can just cohabitate with the environment.
That Dakar is the contemporary art capital of the continent gives the work a particularly large platform, she says.
And people are looking at the art piece. People ask questions. And that's, I think, the beginning of the conversation to really make people involved and paying more attention.
Organizers say they plan to commission local artists to create new sculptures that will be added to the exhibit over time. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A historic drought is threatening millions of lives in the Horn of Africa. To bring immediate relief to the most vulnerable people, the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, is providing nearly $105 million in humanitarian aid. This is the fourth consecutive failed rainy season, which is increasing the likelihood of famine for hundreds of thousands of people in the Horn of Africa. A fifth rainy season is forecast to be drier than average, further devastating livelihoods for families who depend on crops and livestock for food to survive. As a result, more than 16 million people need immediate humanitarian assistance. The number is expected to rise to unprecedented levels, with up to 20 million people in need of help by September. The additional funding will enable USAID partners to provide food, health, and nutrition services and access to clean water. The funding also supports safe spaces and case management for women and girls displaced by drought. Russia's brutal, unprovoked war on Ukraine is deepening the food crisis in the Horn of Africa as food, fuel, and fertilizer prices soar and shortages worsen. Like other regions in the Middle East and Africa, the Horn can no longer import wheat and other grains from Ukraine due to Russia's full-scale invasion, putting millions of women, men, and children at risk of death if they do not find sufficient food. Almost 70% of Somalia's grain and almost 10% of Kenya's come from Ukraine. The United States is the largest single country donor of humanitarian assistance to the Horn of Africa, providing more than $507 million across the region since the beginning of fiscal year 2020. But more funding is urgently required from other donors. Given the severity of the drought and the scale of humanitarian needs, the U.S. government is urging other donors to increase their assistance to prevent famine and save the lives of millions of people. The United States cannot meet the needs in the region on its own. It is time for the donor community to come together to prevent more suffering and save lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Justin Twaits, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.